Tonight on Arena, we look back at some of our musical highlights from 2021. Hello and welcome to Tuesday Night's Arena, and among the special moments we'll be sharing with you over the next hour or so, memories of and music from Paddy Maloney, Leonard Bernstein's West Side Story at 60, soprano Claudia Boyle and Mick Flannery and Susan O'Neill. And where better to start than by paying tribute to a true giant of Irish music. On October the 12th of this year, the world of traditional Irish music lost one of its greatest and most loved figures, the piper, Bowron player, multi-instrumentalist and Chieftains co-founder Paddy Maloney. Here on Arena, we paid tribute to Paddy's legacy in the company of fellow musicians Donal Lunny, Padraig O'Reilly, Moya Brennan, Andrea Carr and others. And amongst the musical selections we played that evening was Cathy Jordan's choice of Mná na hÉireann, as recorded by Kate Bush with Paddy Maloney and the Chieftains in 1996. I don't know what Gaeltacht Kate Bush spent time in to get the words for Mná na hÉireann there, but Padraig O'Reilly, Gonairi Leigh, Coach Dishgaka, she has the Gaeilge.
There's no excuse for anyone to say they couldn't learn Irish.
Yeah.
And she had great blast there.
Yeah, she certainly had, although you were saying that perhaps the content of the song, it's nice to hear it in that lovely lyrical version because it's a little bit bawdier than the lyricism suggests.
Well, if you study the words, maybe it mightn't be so popular in certain quarters.
Yeah. She took great care with that, Donal.
She did indeed, yeah. I mean, I can remember at the time it was in the 90s and faxes were the thing and there being a flood of exchanges, and it was she learned it phonetically and... You know, then she recorded versions of it and, you know, there were various corrections, but she really wanted to get it right.
She certainly did that. But that kind of, that pop star attraction, I mean, Cathy Jordan was touching on it when she was talking to us there. You know, Mick Jagger, Mark Knopfler, the list just goes on and on. Sting, they're all in there. I mean, how did he manage that? He really brought the music into the world of music. It wasn't Irish traditional music. There was no label on it. That's music.
Right. That's right. Yeah, I don't know. I began to think of, in fact, the Chieftains became so ubiquitous, they were everywhere, that it was like they were an expensive accessory. But in fact, it was a lot more than that. You know, they made their own call it a genre, if you like, you know, and they embraced an awful lot of other music in what they were doing. I mean, that the album that they made, The Long Black Veil, was the sort of, that really embodied the whole thing. It was that covered a huge area of the pop scene as well, you know.
And did you get a sense, Sean, even from your father, Sean Potts, and from Paddy, obviously you weren't around at the moment that the Chieftains were being formed, but was that sense of experimentation, that sense of constantly wanting to push boundaries, did you always get that off them?
I did, from as soon as I realised that the music in the 1970s when I started playing myself. I was always drawn to the early recordings and the somewhat continuity of what maybe O'Reilly had set out to do, which was bring ensembles together and create arrangements around music, different layers bringing in. But I always found it was an experimentation. My father was the same. He came, even in his own family, from Tommy Potts' time, there was sort of this experimental sort of intention in their music. And I remember when they recorded the Tim Whistles record together, himself and Paddy, there was something controversial in the traditional music scene that they had taken a few melodies and started to play counter melodies on top of each other. And, you know, it was something very innovative and pioneering for its time. And I'm drawn by the layers in those early recordings before they had the ability, technical ability to do things in recording studios that we have now or we take for granted now. It was quite extraordinary what Paddy did in building, you know, this depth of sound. And it's funny that if you look at the different phases of the Chieftain, I think there was a changing point when my own father, Mick Tuberty, left in 1979 and Matt came on board, and then they became more collaborative, I suppose, in their later years. But that sound I spoke about at the very outset that Paddy was able to get into the channel, that still resonates through the Mick Jaggers and Sting. And I always hear that sound, and Donald spoke about the creation of this. So that still existed, even through the collaborative years and playing with different musicians, sure, different genres.
I know, Sean, when we spoke just a couple of weeks, it was last week, we were speaking about the concert around, the two concerts around your father's music and Cold Hoary Coolin. And I played a clip from an interview there when your father wasn't suffering fools lightly. But there was another clip, and I listened to it carefully in that interview, and he was careful to say he thought that the Chieftains were doing something that was to be lauded. He wasn't dismissing it at all.
No, well, I mean, Sean was a straight talker, and he was doorstepped at the airport by Liam Nolan that time. His attitude was, good luck to them, you know. Now, there's a little bit of strain in the fact that the Chieftains are doing so well commercially, and Sean was kind of moving away from Cold Hoary Coolin. In fact, he said a couple of times he was going to disband them. But then towards the end, he had bigger plans again, and I don't know, was that influenced by Paddy's success? But one thing I'd like to say about Paddy is he was very musical. He had a great ear, so he would listen to lots of stuff, and he could hear stuff and resonate with that, and then he could... he made the connection with all these other great artists. They didn't make the connection with him. And if it wasn't... I don't think the Long Veil would have happened except for Paddy's ear.
Yeah.
And bringing those in. And I mean, who in the hell would think of going to China?
Yeah. So the Chieftains in China was such a huge moment, don't
they? That's right.
You know, and his facility to take on board, it would seem, lots of musical influences. Mm-hmm. And somehow neither throw away the influence he was taking aboard nor his own tradition.
Yes. Well, he definitely had a talent for combining Irish music and his own playing with other cultures. You know, and that required courage as well as everything else, and conviction, you know. But Paddy pulled it off. He was brilliant at mustering various music forms inside his own orbit, you know, and inside the orbit of the Chieftains.
He was what you would call a buchdana. He was courage, he was bold. He'd strike out where other people would be afraid to go.
Yeah, so you're using the word bold. Using the word bold there in that sense.
As in dana, like Sagastakadana, shoving boldly.
Moving forward. And you chose a piece for us, Sean, around Bonaparte's Retreat that gives us a sense of what you reckon is the real brilliance of Paddy Maloney.
Well, certainly the creative arrangement in this is, I believe, unrivaled in the history of music, in Irish music. It is an exemplary piece. Mm. It was the Chieftains had gone full time. They only went full time in 1975. It's interesting, they performed in 1962. Mm. It was a big move for them. They left their jobs and they moved away, and the creative process was gaining speed among the group. He was surrounded by extraordinary musicians, and I think the contribution in this piece and I'll speak my own father, beautiful contribution in this piece as well. Derek Bell came aboard as a classical musician and brought different instrumentation and experimental ideas to the creative process. And then there was Sean Keane's extraordinary fiddle playing and tone, which came in. But this particular piece, the whole theme of it is associated with Napoleon and Bonaparte and the 1798 and post 1798, and all the body of music that exists in our repertoire related to that. And this is one excerpt from where they start playing around with the melody of the Marseillaise. They take the hornpipe, Bonaparte's Retreat itself, they work into them and let you play it there.
Yeah, let's have a listen to how it all starts to meld together. Parts Retreat there from The Chieftains, and that was taken from our show of October the 12th, where we marked the passing of the legendary Paddy Maloney. And in there you heard the voices of Sean Og Potts, son of Chieftains founder Sean Potts, along with Donal Lunny and Padraig O'Reada. When Alice's Adventures Underground was staged at the Royal Opera House in Covent Garden at the beginning of 2020, it was hailed as one of the operatic events of the year. A co-production between the Irish National Opera and the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, the opera's music and libretto was written by Irish composer Gerald Barry, and the resulting show was every bit as frenetic and exhilarating as its source material, Lewis Carroll's two Alice books. In early November, as the opera was beginning to be streamed through the website of the Irish National Opera, Alice herself, in the person of Claudia Boyle, joined us on Arena. I began by asking her about the unique challenge of performing Gerald Barry's work, particularly those relentless high seas. A total of how many, I wondered? 96?
Hands up, I've never counted them. Sean, I have two babies now, so I've got better things to be doing than opening the score counting high seas. But no, I've never actually sat down, but there's a hell of a lot of them. So it's very exciting, you know, it's very fast paced, it's very extreme. It's extreme writing. But as a high soprano, I love it. And Gerald Barry loves high sopranos, so he writes really well for them.
Yeah, and you were saying that, so this was the production was actually done back, when was it? You can probably tell me the precise date, because you've had your second baby quite recently, actually, haven't you?
Yeah, I'm 7 weeks tomorrow. I had a baby boy, So, no, it was great. We actually filmed and recorded this in May, so I was about 5 months pregnant for it, which was great. Actually, you know, I love singing with a little life inside you. It's a lovely thing to be able to do, I have to say. It's great. I mean, apart from what I didn't like was the sickness and all of that kind of thing, but actually to sing while you're pregnant is a lovely thing.
Yeah, well, the fact that you sang this 5 months pregnant. Now, what we're talking about tonight is the stream version, because it's now available on the Irish National Opera website in this streamed version, which was done, I presume, was it recorded around the time of the, it was one of the performances in the Royal Opera House, was it?
A
mixture of performances possibly.
Yeah, I mean, the Royal Opera House was actually, we were very, very fortunate because it debuted in the Royal Opera House in just before the pandemic hit. Mm. So it was in February 2019. So yeah, we were really, really lucky. And it just got such a great reaction. Word travelled so quickly that as soon as the opening night happened, all of the rest of the shows just sold out. Mm. What was great about it is a younger audience came to it, and you'd hear the odd little child in the audience, you know, these little gasps and everything like that. But that is such a great thing to have as an opera singer, you know, to hear reactions like that and hear a younger audience really engaging with it. But then Irish National Opera decided to record and film this, so we recorded it this year. So we actually recorded it. We recorded it in Limerick, and then we actually staged it then and filmed it in the Wexford Opera House. Yeah.
And was it a straight through, because I'm still obsessed with these 96 high C's, was it a straight through recording, or were there a number of retakes? We'll just set back to the beginning of that number and we'll go again, please, Claudia, or how
did
it work?
Yeah, there was a little bit of that. I mean, it's very, you know, it's so fast paced that the scenes just go straight into each other. So we basically did it just scene by scene. And then, you know, we would do it a couple of times each, and if he was happy with the thing he got, then, you know, that was great. Then we moved on and different angles like that. So,
This is the first thing that you, as Alice, have to sing, you know, pretty much the minute the opera starts. There's no kind of, we'll have to give you a nice little bit of instrumental
music
to warm
you
up. So this is how it starts, Alice's Adventures Underground.
I shall be too late!
I actually counted 12 in the first. That's a 2 minutes and 9 seconds, that little section that I have there. And we played 1 minute of it.
Okay, well, there you go. Well, then so
one every 5 seconds, more or less. That
maybe
you
there is 96 of them, but there you go. No, I have to say, it's really, really exciting. And it brings me back to being behind the curtain in Covent Garden when it was just about to open, because it was my debut there as well. And it was just really, really exciting. But I find the writing really exciting. It's you know, I was saying to you before we went on, it's really instrumental. And that's, you know, that's really exciting. Like, what can the voice do, really?
I know that's only the opening minute of the opera, and it's not all arpeggios and scales, which is what you're getting there, swapping between the C minor, the C major and the C minor arpeggio, and the C major and C minor scale. What he asks of the voice. Sometimes I wonder, you know, we were talking about this upstairs. Sometimes when something is as extreme almost as that, it's, in inverted commas, easier to do than something that is this big, long, slow, melodic line where, you know, there's no chance to kind of recoup. Is there a sense of that, that sometimes something that is quite flashy isn't as hard as it sounds?
Well, it depends what voice type you are anyway with that. But I mean, listen, things, there are different technical difficulties in different pieces of music. So, I mean, you might have a very slow, sustained piece of music where, you know, you really have to have your breathing is so secure and create this beautiful sound. And then in something like this, it has to be so accurate because, you know, Gerald has you repeating everything that the orchestra plays. And if you don't repeat it exactly how they play it,
it's really obvious.
You're going to notice it. It's C major. It's a very, very open and bright chord. And you're going to notice if it's not bang on. So, you know, they do pose different problems. But I have to say, I love it. I remember opening the score and seeing the music on the page, and it really got me excited because, you know, I just being a high soprano, I'm excited by music like this, and I love singing it. So, yeah, it's a joy, you have to say.
The other thing, the other aspect of the production is, as if the singing demands weren't enough, the physical demands in this production are pretty huge, certainly from the sections that I was watching today. It moves, the action of the opera moves with the same freneticism as the music of the opera.
Yeah, I mean, it's only 53 minutes long. So it's very, very short, and, you know, it fits in so many different scenes and characters from both books, you know, from the original Alice's Adventures Underground and then Through the Looking Glass as well. So it's kind of a mishmash of both books. And the scenes just segue from one to the other. They're very quick, very fast paced. So it's fitting all of that in. So Alice kind of navigates herself through this world. So it is going to be very, very physical, and how she reacts and responds to each character that she meets. And it is very dreamlike. It's very fantastic. You know, it's bizarre. The world is turned on its head. So I really played with the kind of physicality of that, and being able to navigate my way through that. So it was great fun. And she's a young child as well, so she has plenty of energy.
And I'm still trying to get past the fact that you were performing this when you were 5 months pregnant as well.
So
there was a lot going on in your body, as the demands that you were making on it.
Yeah, there was. Now, I have to say, obviously, I was very aware of that as well. You know, I'm not going to do something that is unsafe or you know, would harm myself in any way. So I was really, really, really careful. But I suppose I like to think of myself as fit as well. And if you're fit and healthy and, you know, you're careful and you do things in a certain way, and I do have dance training as well, so that certainly helps in what I do.
Just wondering if your son is going to say to you at some stage later, I've heard a lot of high C's somewhere before,
Mum.
I just don't know why I'm so familiar with that
note. You probably have nightmares. I was actually sent a little clip of this, and I was feeding him the other day, and his eyes actually did pop open when he heard the... Now, whether that was an association
moment
or not,
of recognition.
We'll never know.
Were you a fan of the books as when you were growing up yourself?
I'll be really honest. No, I wasn't. I, you know, completely honest about
linguistically,
that.
They are very difficult. You know,
they
I often
are.
Think, you know, older children possibly for very young children, they are quite difficult.
Yeah, and I remember I was introduced to it as a younger child, and there is a darkness to them.
Oh, yeah.
I have to say, you know, these kind of characters, they're a bit psychotic, and these anthropomorphic creatures that she kind of meets, you know, there's something unsettling, and certainly as a child I picked up on that, and it wasn't, I didn't take to it. I mean, you know, if my mum or dad, you know, read me Roald Dahl or something, well, that's very obviously there's an honesty in it, but there was an underlying darkness to his his books that I yeah, just picked up on.
Alice shrinking and not knowing how small am I going to get? Am I going to disappear?
Exactly. I mean, there's something scary about that.
And then she grows, and how big am I going to get?
Exactly.
You know?
And everything has turned on its head and it's unsettling. Mm. And again, these characters, they're larger than life, but they are a bit unhinged.
Yeah.
And,
well, Humpty Dumpty was a big fan of Beethoven, certainly in Gerald Barry's mind.
Yeah.
It's interesting what Gerald Barry does here. He takes the Ode to Joy, his Beethoven setting of the Ode to Joy from the Choral Symphony, the ninth and final symphony of Beethoven, and he gives that to Humpty Dumpty. And let's listen to it. This is just one of the parts where... Who played the part of Humpty Dumpty in the... Do you remember?
It was Alan Ewing.
Alan Ewing.
Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah. Brilliant actor as well.
Super sound off him here, as you'll hear. So here he is, first of all, with him singing the Ode to Joy. And then everybody joins in. And if you thought that your high C's were fast, wait till you hear the chorus and the lot of you sing at the end of this.
I took a corkscrew from the shelf. I went and pushed and kicked and knocked. And when I found the door was shut, I tried to turn the handle, but...
My husband, 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 my
Alan Ewing as Humpty Dumpty, with the chorus of Alice's Adventures Underground, with a version of sorts of Beethoven's Ode to Joy as interpreted by Irish composer Gerald Barry. And we were speaking earlier to the star of Gerald Barry's opera Alice's Adventures Underground, Claudia Boyle. She joined us on Arena in early November. We'll be back with more musical highlights from Arena after this short break. Welcome back to Arena, where tonight we're looking at some of the musical highlights on the show from the last few months. In another exceptional year for Irish contemporary folk music, one of the highlights in terms of album releases came from singer and songwriter Mick Flannery and his collaboration with singer Susan O'Neill. With six albums under his belt, three of which have gone to number one in Ireland, Mick is a relative veteran compared to his new collaborator Susan. That said, both have enjoyed enormous acclaim as solo artists. But this collaboration, in the form of the album In the Game, won over critics and audiences alike. They came in to speak about their highly productive partnership shortly after the album's release in early September, and we opened with one of the singles from the album. This is Baby Talk.
My baby take on his devil. My baby don't sulk inside. My baby don't run from trouble. My baby don't wonder why.
Write a story for me in your mind and let it run. Lies and tides turn until the both of us are done. With guards in the darkness, baby, just before the dawn. Don't do that, baby voice.
Baby Talk, the title of that song from the new album from Mick Flannery and Susan O'Neill, and that new album called In the Game. Mick, yourself and Susan, I think you were doing gigs together back in 2019. You were working on that song, Baby Talk, I think by yourself, and saying, I can't quite get it finished. But when I heard Susan singing that opening verse of the song, I wondered, did the song transform when you started thinking about it more as a duet rather than a piece for you to sing yourself?
It did, yeah. The duet idea really helped me to put a lyric to the song. I had the tune fairly much constructed, but I had no idea where to go with the words of it. Putting the kind of back and forth of that conversation between the two characters really helped me to.
And how quickly then did both yourself and Susan start to think, you know, we can do more than this song. In fact, we can do a bundle of songs together and maybe even tell a kind of a story, which is what you do across the 14 songs of the album. It's kind of a love story. Boy and girl meet, things are good, sometimes they're bad, and then it moves in the way that sad love stories often go.
Yeah. Well, we had that song and there was a good reaction to the song, and we had another co-write in the bag as well, which was called Trouble. and we were kind of in the on, going along the vein of a smaller kind of project, maybe like an EP.
Mm.
But the more that we kind of got stuck into the storyline of it, and we kept kind of gathering songs together, so we ended up having perhaps too many.
Well, not necessarily too many at all. Susan is there as well. Your own musical background, Susan, you've been associated with the dance band King Kong Company. You've also played with traditional music queen Sharon Shannon. So, and you're a multi-instrumentalist. I know you play both trumpet and harmonica on this album, and I believe there are other instruments that you have under your belt as well. How would you describe your own music, or what you do outside of what you do with what you're doing with Mick here?
Well, I guess it's very collaborative based. So far, I've always enjoyed working with musicians from many different genres, and I guess finding the space where maybe I could add something to that.
Hmm.
And, you know, find something within the music where, yeah, just to embellish the music a little bit. And I suppose, yeah, between folk, trad and kind of techno.
Yeah.
I don't know where it lands.
Yeah, well, let it land in all of the places. We don't need to narrow it down necessarily at all, do we? But what was your reaction when Mick, I know you were gigging together, Mick gave you shared the song with you, said, look, I'm working on this. How quickly did you realise that a collaboration with Mick was on the cards here, and what was your feeling around that?
Yeah, well, Mick had sent me the track Baby Talk. We had done a co-write first, but never recorded it. So it was kind of sitting there, and I knew that our, you know, musical sensitivities were kind of similar and tastes. But then when he sent me, I think he had recorded the basses and the drums and some of the piano parts to Baby Talk in LA with Tony Buchan, and then he sent me that track. And I just loved the sound of it straight away. I just thought, this is really cool. He said, do you want to do a vocal on it? And, you know, and I actually did my vocal in Milltown Malbay.
Hmm.
With so, you know, it really did come together from all corners of the globe.
Yeah, separately.
And
living separately together and working separately together was what you were doing. Looking across the track listing, Mick, specific songs are attributed to either yourself or Susan, and Trouble, as you mentioned there, attributed to both of you. So how exactly did the collaborative process work? I mean, did one or other of you take the lead on a particular song and then the other person add a little bit to it, or what was the process, Mick?
Well, we had different kind of restrictions kind of over us for the different times that we were writing. So for some amount of weeks that we couldn't travel to the same room together, you know. So we had to kind of work separately. We would every now and again have a call and share the songs that we thought were fitting in with the album. And we would kind of make arrangements, do demos, and leave space for either myself or Susan to sing certain parts, and kind of make, you know, make decisions on who would sing what line where and where would we.
Yeah, so one person came along with, I suppose, the initial idea, and then the other started to throw in his or her.
Together and
yeah.
Stuff like that.
Tell me a little bit then, Susan, about the song These Are the Days, which is, again, on the liner notes, this is attributed to you. So this was your idea initially, I'm guessing.
Some of the initial kind of parts I had written in Doolin while staying there over the lockdown. And, you know, it was just something that I thought kind of fitted into the storyline. I had originally started writing it as Mick had done with some of his tracks. You know, it began as a one-person story, and then we were able to kind of split up the narrative so that it was two people looking back with nostalgia on the past, and I suppose feeling that they were better to have tried something, but you know, yeah. And it just tied into the storyline, so it was beautiful to add that to the mix as well.
Let's have a listen to These Other Days.
Solution.
Are the Days by Mick Flannery and Susan O'Neill, and that is taken from their acclaimed album In the Game. And in fact, since that interview in September, another song from the album, Chain Reaction, scooped the award for the Best Original Folk Track at the RTE Radio 1 Folk Awards in November. So congratulations to Mick Flannery and Susan O'Neill on that. Join us after the break when we'll be speaking to Jamie Bernstein, daughter of the legendary West Side Story composer Leonard Bernstein, to celebrate 60 years of the movie version of that classic musical. Welcome back to the final part of tonight's Arena, looking back on our favourite musical moments from the show over the past few months. On October the 18th, 1961, exactly 60 years ago, cinema audiences were treated to a musical, lyrical and choreographic spectacular which, according to many, has never been matched. The show in question had been a huge hit on Broadway and its arrival to cinema screens was one of the most anticipated events of the year. Even now, six decades on, West Side Story remains unrivalled. On that 60th anniversary, I had the pleasure of speaking to Jamie Bernstein, the daughter of Leonard Bernstein, and she spoke of her love of the musical and her memories of her father. I started the interview with one of the many memorable moments from this extraordinary work.
Buying on credit is so nice.
One look at us and they charge twice.
I have my own washing machine.
What will you have though to keep clean?
Skyscrapers bloom in America.
America, from the motion picture soundtrack to West Side Story, the 1961 movie that scooped a total of 10 Oscars, including Best Picture. Music by Leonard Bernstein, words by Stephen Sondheim, choreography by Jerome Robbins. It's still, if for many critics, the choice as the best musical of all time. On the film's 60th anniversary, I'm delighted to be joined by Jamie Bernstein, daughter of Leonard and author of the book Famous Father Girl, to talk about her memories of that time and the impact of this great work. You were very wrong. Lovely to have you with us this evening, Jamie. You were very young when it was a Broadway hit for sure. What age were you then, and what age were you when the film finally hit the screens?
Yes, it's true. Yeah, very nice to be with all of you over there in Ireland from here in New York City, which is where I was with my family when my father was writing West Side Story all the way back in 1956 or thereabouts. I guess it opened in 1957. So I was just little. I was like 4 years old. And so I really have very vague, if any, memories of my father actually putting the show together. All I can remember is that his studio, which was off the front hall in our apartment, when the collaborators were in there working with him, Jerome Robbins and Steve Sondheim and the book writer Arthur Lawrence, all I could see was a giant haze of cigarette smoke. And I knew they were in there working. It was just this, you know, smelly cloud of gray fume.
Yeah.
Kind of horrible. But it was really the movie that made the show click for me, because by the time the film came out, I was about 10.
Yeah.
And then I was the right age to really appreciate it. And then I got very excited. I already had the recording. So my brother and I had worn out the grooves on the record. So we knew the score backwards and forwards. But when we finally saw the film, then it all really came together for us.
And I suppose, as you say, you were at an age then, 9 or 10, where maybe the subtleties of what was going on would speak more directly to you. How important was the Romeo and Juliet aspect of the story for you? Obviously, that's what it is. And West Side Story is a New York 1950s, 60s retelling of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet.
It certainly is. And I will tell you that I learned about West Side Story long before I learned about Romeo and Juliet, because, you know, who reads Romeo and Juliet when they're 4 or 5 or even 10 years old? So I came around to it backwards, working backwards from West Side Story.
And when you did get to Romeo and Juliet, just as a slight sidebar, how exciting was it then to say, oh, that this is what my father has been working on, was working on all those years in the smoky room?
Exactly. Well, it was quite thrilling, and it was fun to see where the correspondences were. And, oh, I see that character is this character, and this is a reference to that thing. And so it made studying Romeo and Juliet lots more fun, of course.
I think it has done that for generations in all countries around the world, probably since its first inception as both a stage show and a musical. Let's go to the balcony scene, because I suppose this kind of transformation, the fact that we're on the fire escapes of these apartment blocks as opposed to a balcony in Verona, it really brings us slap bang into the centre of New York. And the action takes place in the alleyway. Maria, played by Natalie Wood, speaks to Tony, played by Richard Boehmer, on the fire escape, as I said, outside the family apartment window.
Shh. It is dangerous. If Bernardo knew...
We will let him know. I'm not one of them, Maria.
But you are not one of us. And I am not one of you.
To me, you're all the beautiful...
Maruca!
Sí, ya vengo, Papa.
Maruca?
His pet name for me.
I like him. And he will like me.
No. He is like Bernardo. Afraid. Imagine being afraid of you.
You see?
I see you.
Oh, Maria, see only me.
The famous balcony scene there from West Side Story, which hit cinema screens on October the 18th, 1961. And during my interview with Jamie Bernstein, daughter of Leonard, she spoke with great passion about her father's sense of social justice and his involvement with liberal causes at a time when support for those causes could be quite damaging to any career. In that context, I finished our interview by asking Jamie for her own personal musical highlight from West Side Story. And here she explains exactly why the song Somewhere had such a special resonance for both her and her father.
Well, I love this song, Somewhere, so much. It contains everything about my father wanting to make the world a better place. You can hear it in the opening notes, that big upward reach interval. There's a place for us. It's so reaching upward for that better world that he is so sure can be out there for us. So it's very moving, and it's become a kind of anthem for a lot of people in the world. It's a song that expresses our longing for a world where we all take care of each other.
Well, listen, thanks so much for being with us this evening, Jamie, and continued enjoyment of your father's work, I'm sure, in the years to come. Let's finish with Somewhere from the original soundtrack. 60 years old is West Side Story.
There's a place for us, a time and place for us. Hold my hand and we're halfway there. Hold my hand and I'll take you there. Somehow, somewhere.
From West Side Story, selected by Jamie Bernstein, my guest in October, when we celebrated the 60th anniversary of her father's musical. And that's nearly it for tonight's look back at the best of music on Arena in recent months. Tomorrow, we'll be talking film in the company of Jeremy Irons and the man behind the musical Hamilton, Lin-Manuel Miranda, who tells us about his new film, Tick, Tick, Boom. But before we go, hip-hop music in Ireland has evolved enormously in recent years, and Dublin rapper Kevin Smith, professionally known as Kojak, is testament to that fact. His debut album, Town's Dead, was released in June, and its themes range from the personal to the political, from comedic to serious social commentary. When I spoke to him around the time of that release, I asked him about the title track of the album, Town's Dead, and the frustration and anger that gave rise to it.
Well, I suppose there's, I guess, a lot of issues just as a young person kind of growing up in Dublin that kind of keep a lot of people in kind of perpetual despair, particularly like the housing crisis and, you know, even the homelessness crisis. And just as a young creative person, it feels like there's not a whole lot of outlets and or facilities kind of there in order to kind of perpetuate the next generation of artists coming up. So I think that just tended to come out a lot in the music when I was writing it.
And given that the album, there's anger in there, but you use the term perpetual despair there. I don't get the sense that you're prepared to just lie down and be desperate and give up on everything. There's quite a lot of energy behind what you're saying. Do you think that's important, not to be pulled down by the despair?
I do. And I think, you know, for all the kind of anger and upset that there is in the album, I do believe that it's quite a hopeful album. And I mean, time and time again, the art that comes out of the city is really what inspires me. And, you know, it shocks me often because it is so difficult as a young person to live in Dublin with all the bands that are coming out, you know, Girl Band, Fontaines DC, For Those I Love. It's just amazing to kind of see the talent that's still there, you know, in the city. It's just a matter of kind of shaking things up and making sure people know.
Was that part of
the talent that we have?
I said that I'm speaking to you from your London base at the moment. Was this the situation in Dublin part of your reason for moving to Dublin, or were there other reasons there too?
No, not really. I was just mixing the album over here and I found a house to live in. And I thought, well, if Dublin's locked down and if here's locked down, you know, what's the difference? So, and it was actually cheaper in the place I could find back in Dublin. So that'll show you something. I grew up in Cabra and, you know, a lot of the flats that were being knocked down, as well as that, they were being knocked down with the promise of affordable housing being built, you know, and then it comes to these affordable houses that are 300, 400 grand to buy, you know what I mean? And it's like, where is there left to go for the people that were turfed out in order to make room for those things, you know? Yeah. So I think oftentimes it feels like you're sold a book.
And that was Town's Dead, the title track from Dublin rapper Kojak's debut album. And Kojak was speaking, as you heard, to Sean Rocks in an interview first broadcast in June 2021. Arena will be back tomorrow evening, where Sean will bring listeners some of the highlights from the show's film interviews from 2021, including interviews with Jeremy Irons and the man behind the musical Hamilton, Lin-Manuel Miranda, speaking about his new film, Tick, Tick, Boom.